have my own rather weepy little postscript to this story. I had always heard of the enchanting and beautiful hotel La Réserve de Beaulieu, which is on the Côte d'Azur, halfway between Monaco and Nice. I had friends who had gone there and had a wonderful time, so I decided to treat myself to a few days of luxury there when my interview with Grace Kelly was over. I would get some sun and relax and maybe meet a new friend or two. I arrived in time for cocktails and was given a small table in the lovely garden. I ordered a glass of wine and sipped it alone. There were Americans at adjoining tables. No one looked in my direction. I was just a single woman sitting alone, and they obviously didn't recognize me, if indeed they had ever seen me on TV. I finished my glass of wine, and when cocktail time was over, I sat on the restaurant's terrace and had my dinner alone. The next morning, I went down to the area of the small swimming pool. All around me were smiling couples chatting away. I, sunned alone, had a large lunch alone, more cocktails alone, and yet another dinner alone. The next morning, I canceled the rest of the weekend and took the first plane home to New York. I don't know who was more lonely, Princess Grace or I. Born in my heart. My homecoming was a happy one, made all the more so because Lee and I were about to begin the most joyous chapter of our life together. After 3 miscarriages, too many hormones, and way too many thermometers, Lee and I came to a conclusion that was both exciting and scary. We would adopt a child. Back in the 60s, it wasn't as difficult to adopt a baby as it is today. Roe v. Wade, the landmark decision by the Supreme Court upholding a woman's right to abortion, would not become federal law until 1973. We thought we were pretty advanced in our thinking, but single mothers were neither cherished nor applauded. Babies born out of wedlock were called illegitimate. Pregnant unmarried women were said to be in trouble and had a hard time making a go of it. They were often sent away on a 7 or 8 month vacation by their anxious parents so they could have their baby away from neighbors' judgmental eyes, and then, many times, the baby would be put up for adoption. As a result of society's stigma, there were more unwanted babies available than there are today. Lee and I went to an adoption agency. At the interview, I expressed my concern that I might not be considered the best candidate because I worked full-time, but the counselor told me that wouldn't be a problem. She also told us that there was a long waiting list. We put our name on the list and said we would wait. And then, this miracle occurred. Lee and I were going to the theater one night with a couple who weren't exactly close friends, more like acquaintances. I used to double date with the woman occasionally before she and I each married. When we ran into each other one day, we said we must get together. This was the night we got together. The woman, let us call her Jane, was now married to an extremely wealthy man, whom we shall call John. His family owned a very large lumber company. After the theater, over supper at Sardi's, a popular theater district restaurant that catered to a show business clientele, Jane told us that she and John had, 2 years earlier, privately adopted a baby girl. They now wanted to adopt a boy. And not just any boy, a tall, blonde, fair-skinned boy to mirror their blonde, blue-eyed, fair-skinned daughter. Since they were short and dark-haired, they obviously weren't thrilled with their own looks. Jane and John were so determined to find that tall, blonde boy that they were once again pursuing private adoption. Most adoption agencies at the time divulged few details about a child's natural parents. Even basic facts like health and family background were kept secret. So Jane and John had asked their company's lawyers to locate prospective unwed mothers of suitable backgrounds and physical characteristics who planned to give up their babies for adoption. The lawyers also met, if possible, with the fathers. The lawyers had a checklist of what to look for when interviewing the parents. For example, had they attended high school? Had they graduated? The lawyers were also instructed to find out if the parents had any possible genetically inherited diseases, like diabetes. I remember being shocked at their calculated approach toward custom tailoring their children, although in these days of designer babies it doesn't seem that strange. But then, All I could think of was Nietzsche's belief in a superior being and Darwin's theories about the survival of the fittest. Lee and I didn't care what the sex of our child would be, or his or her hair color or height. We just wanted a healthy baby. Then came an offer we couldn't refuse. Jane and John wanted a boy, period. Again, back in the 60s, there was no way of knowing before the baby was born what sex it would be. So they were looking for a couple who would absolutely agree to take the baby if the child was a girl. Lee and I looked at each other and said, almost simultaneously, "We will." We told no one. We did not decorate a nursery. We did not buy a layette. We waited quietly. Jane called from time to time to say the lawyers had met this woman or that couple, but no one who fitted their specifications. Finally, they felt they had found just the right candidate. The mother-to-be was single and came from a good family. The parents did not know their daughter was pregnant. She was living in a different state and was only 19, so she did not feel she could take on the responsibility of raising a child. Both she and the father-to-be were tall and fair-haired, no known hereditary diseases. We continued to wait. Then came the unforgettable day. I had just gotten off the air and was myself being interviewed by a print journalist when my phone rang. It was Lee. "It's a girl," Lee said. "She's ours." I looked at the woman who was interviewing me and burst into tears. "I'm a mother," I sobbed happily, and swore her to secrecy. Actually, I swore everyone in the office close to me to secrecy. I didn't want the word to reach the papers for fear our baby's biological mother would learn we were the parents. But what I really wanted to do was to rush up and down Rockefeller Plaza and shout out the news, "We have a baby! We have a baby! Hallelujah!" I was out of my mind with joy and couldn't wait to see her. That night, Lee and I laughed and cried. We made love without worrying whether or not it was the right time of the month. We bought airline tickets to fly to the state where the baby was born. The hospital told us we'd have to wait until the infant was 4 days old before she could leave the hospital. The birth mother was fine. She had no idea who we were and had no desire to meet us. Nor did we want to meet her. Remember, this was long before the idea of open adoptions became a reality or even an option. The identity of adopted children and their birth parents was kept sealed and not available to the child or the new parents. This was considered the best way. The adoptive parents could handle the situation however they wanted and tell their child whatever they wanted. I don't know if Jane and John ever found their fair-haired, blue-eyed, very tall son. After the birth of the baby, we lost touch. But let me just tell you that my daughter has blue eyes, fair hair, and today she is slightly over 6 feet tall. I immediately told my parents and sister, who were living in New York at the time, about the baby's birth. They were ecstatic. We decided to name the baby Jacqueline after my sister. This was fine with Lee. For my sister, this naming was truly meaningful. She was now in her early 40s. She would never have her own child, and baby Jackie would help to fill that need. Right after I told my family, I told my producer, but I also said that I would not mention the baby's birth on the air, nor would I send out announcements. Again, I was afraid the birth mother would put two and two together and realize that I was the woman who now was parent to her baby and didn't want her to be in touch with me, or eventually with Jackie. To this day, she never has been. She must have wanted secrecy, too. All we knew about our baby was that she was healthy. We knew there was no diabetes in her family. We were also told the mother had a high IQ and that she was not Jewish. In turn, the birth mother knew almost nothing about us, except that we were married and would be loving parents. She didn't care in what religion her baby would be raised. We paid all the birth mother's hospital expenses and her lawyer's fee. That was that. The same day as the wondrous phone call, I called my cousin Lorraine in Asbury Park, New Jersey. She had followed her father into the clothing business and owned a children's store. Lorraine, who knew much more about what I would need for the baby than I did, immediately sent me a complete layette. Bibs, diaper covers, undershirts, one-piece jumpers, blankets, sheets, towels. She also sent a bathinette and a changing table with compartments for diapers, everything I would need. A close friend loaned me her own baby's bassinet and later her crib. The new baby would sleep in what had been our library. It had dark brown fake leather walls. Very chic for a library, very grim for a nursery. No time to paint. Our creative set designer on today made us huge pastel butterflies. We hung them on the walls, and the room was suddenly enchanting. We hastily called a domestic employment agency, did some quick interviewing, and hired an experienced baby nurse. 4 days after the baby's birth, we flew to pick her up. On the one hand, I was impatient with desire to hold her in my arms. On the other hand, I was nervous. Would I even know how to hold her? I hadn't had much experience with babies and had no parenting lessons. Maternal instinct would have to make everything all right. I had brought with me a soft flannel one-piece pink bunting for our new daughter, along with a white cuddly blanket, diapers, a bottle, formula, whatever I was told was necessary. I was more or less prepared. I didn't want to go to the receiving floor where the baby was to be delivered to us because I was afraid of meeting the birth mother. Lee went upstairs with the bunting. A nurse then dressed the infant and put her into Lee's arms. He came downstairs and put our baby in my arms. Even as I write this, I get tears in my eyes. I cannot properly express my joy as I welcomed this tiny pink bundle. Her face was partially covered by the blanket, so I gently pulled it back. My daughter Jackie was the most beautiful baby I had ever seen. Perfect features, one little dimple in her left cheek. My cousin Shirley, when she first saw Jackie, said, "She has a mouth like a rosebud. No hair, just some blonde fuzz, blue eyes, perfect hands and feet, perfect." According to the baby book I immediately began to keep, our daughter weighed 7 pounds and was 21 inches long, a little longer than average. Later on, I also noted in the book that she smiled spontaneously at the age of 1 month. Could it have been gas? She discovered her hands and feet at 12 weeks and recognized Lee and me easily by 4 months. She crawled by 8 months and was, of course, the most brilliant baby ever born. Not only that, she may well have been the only baby born that year who had to lie about her age. After receiving Jackie, Lee and I went immediately to the airport. "How old is the baby?" we were asked at the check-in counter. 4 days, we said proudly. "Too young to fly," said the ticket agent. "A baby has to be 8 days old to be allowed to fly." We turned in our tickets and went to another airline. 8 days, we said. And we boarded a plane with our sleeping infant. I changed her diaper on the plane, awkwardly. Diapers were cloth then and fastened with huge safety pins. I stabbed myself several times before I got the hang of it. I fed her a bottle. I held her to my chest, to my face, to my lips. "She is ours," Lee kept saying. "She is ours." 7 days earlier, we had no way of knowing if we would ever have a child. Now, we were parents. And my parents were grandparents. My sister was her aunt. From the time of the baby's birth, there was no thought in their minds that she wasn't their flesh and blood. I don't think they ever used the word adoption to me. Their newborn granddaughter was theirs, and by theirs, I mean all three of them. And that was fine with me. I wanted them to feel that the child was as much a part of them as she was of Lee and me. Judging from the way they doted on her, they did. All three couldn't get enough of her. When Jackie was born, Lee's son and daughter were in their late teens. They were very sweet with her, but they had their own interests as well as other younger half-sisters and brothers, for their mother had also remarried. So although they held their new baby sister, made the proper cooing noises, and never expressed any jealousy, Jackie was not really a part of their lives. You can read all the baby books on the care and handling of an infant, but nothing prepares you for the reality. I remember the sweetness of the smell of a newborn. It is the purest, most delicious scent. I remember how teeny she was and my fear that I wasn't supporting her head properly when I bent over to take her in my arms. I remember testing the water of her little bassinet with my elbow, as I had been told to do, to make sure the water was not too hot. Both Lee and I diapered her. In those days, you scraped the diapers clean into the toilet before you rinsed them out and put them in a big hamper for a diaper service to pick up. Nothing was too much. Everything about this beautiful little creature was wondrous. In particular, I thought my Jackie had beautiful legs. Now, almost 40 years later, she still does. I also delighted in that one little dimple on her left cheek. How adorable. In the months after Jackie's birth, I didn't say a word about her on the air. When I finally began to talk about her, I got letters from some viewers saying that they had known all along that I was pregnant. They could see it. By the way, had I actually been pregnant, I would not have been allowed to appear on the air unless I disguised my pregnancy. Pregnancy was hidden then. In her stint as a Today girl in the 50s, a pregnant Florence Henderson was always shot from behind the desk. But then again, there were few women on live TV at that time, pregnant or not. When Jackie got older, I didn't bring her into the studio the way many working mothers do today. Now, if you are on television and have a child, you can carry the baby in, change it, nurse it, put it down to sleep, and everybody oohs and ahs as they should. Some cast members on daily talk programs even negotiate a special room for their babies and nannies. When Rosie O'Donnell was doing her own daytime talk show at NBC, she had a whole nursery set up, not just for her own children, but for the small children of members of her crew. It was like a daycare center. But when Jackie was born, children weren't welcome. It would have been like bringing in a puppy who wasn't housebroken. I tried to stay home as much as possible. On the nurse's day off, Lee stayed with Jackie until I got off the air at 9 a.m. and raced back to the apartment. I loved to give Jackie her bottle, although the pediatrician told me that she was what was known as a spitter. After she was fed her bottle, she would regurgitate quite a bit of the formula when you burped her. I became an excellent burper, but my clothes were getting ruined. My mother solved the problem by buying me a bunch of cotton dresses called swirls. You tied them around you, and they covered whatever you were wearing. Jackie finally grew out of her spitting phase, but to this day she has a bit of a weak stomach, only she won't let me burp her. Jackie was never with an occasional babysitter. During her first 2 years of life, we hired two different women who were qualified, experienced infant nurses. They didn't want to stay with the family for more than a year, as they deliberately resisted getting to love the child too much. I'd heard of nurses who resented the fact that the mother wanted to be a mother, and I made certain that mine allowed plenty of time and space for mommy. I wasn't nursing Jackie, so it was all the more important for me to feed her her bottle as often as I could. That included her 5 a.m. feeding. After all, I was already awake myself. When Jackie turned 3, two amazing women came into her world. They were so integral to her life and mine that I want to introduce you to them. One was a vivacious, extremely intelligent French woman named Thérèse de la Chapelle. She asked us to call her Mademoiselle, which we shortened to Zelle. Everyone who ever came into our house knew Zelle. I could write a book just about Zelle. She came from a distinguished family who had an old but still very much lived-in chateau close to Lyon in France. Her father was a baron, her mother a baroness. When her beloved Bonmaman died, Zelle herself became a baroness. Not that it did her any good. She was the eldest of 14 children, and as her large family needed the money after World War II, she was sent all alone to this country to take care of relatives in Chicago. There she learned English and stayed until her relatives said they no longer needed her help. She then moved to New York and helped to raise a little boy whose mother was an alcoholic until he was ready for boarding school. I heard about Zelle from friends of the boy's mother, Zell remained close to this child all his life. Ours was only the third position Zell had ever taken. I remember the first day she came to us. Jackie was barely three, and it was time for us to hire someone who we hoped would take a permanent position. I was on the telephone, of course, when Mademoiselle de la Chapelle arrived. While I was talking, Jackie toddled up to Zell and put her tiny hand in hers. It was love at first sight for both of them. Zell never took a day off until the summer months. Then she would return to France. I was usually on vacation during that time and could take care of Jackie myself. Zell would return to us in New York in late summer. Practically every nickel she made went to her family to keep up the ancient chateau. But the reality was that in short order, Zell became part of our family. Our home was her home in every sense of the word. She was involved with all aspects of Jackie's life, and when Jackie was grown, Zell more or less became my governess. She was a great character. She was teeny tiny skinny and never seemed to eat. She hoarded every present she ever got, a result, I think, of her wartime experience and having to do without. In all the years she lived with me, she never called me by either my first or last name. If she came into my room, she would say simply, "Knock, knock." And if she had to take or give a message, she would simply say, "Your friend said," and so on. After Jackie outgrew needing a governess, Zell ran the house. She did the marketing, checked all the bills, answered all the phones, ran errands. Everyone in the neighborhood knew her, helped out if we entertained. She was a bundle of energy, running, running, running. Zell stayed with us for 34 years until she became very ill and felt she should return to France for good. She missed us terribly, and I missed her more than I can adequately express. I made sure she had the best medical care, but Zell died in her family home in 2004. Jackie was, by then, long grown up, but she and I cried together when we got the news about Zell's death. And to this day, we tell each other Zell stories. By the time Jackie was a toddler, I was making pretty good money, so I could afford two helpers. Zell took care of Jackie. Another amazing woman did everything else. Her name is Icodel Tomlinson, and she and I have lived together now for almost 35 years. Icodel came to live with us shortly after she left her native island of Jamaica. She is now an American citizen. During our years together, she managed to raise a daughter and three sons. Her son Philip graduated from the Columbia School of Journalism. Her daughter Yvette got her master's degree from the Tisch School of the Arts at New York University. We all rejoiced at Yvette's wedding a few years back when she married one of my tape editors, Mark Burns. Icodel's children are part of my life, too. Icodel brought into our home her great humor, special wisdom, and the most loving heart, and she became the backbone of our small family. I have never heard her raise her voice or criticize anyone. She did most of the cooking and cared for our home, although she had her own apartment. When Zell didn't interfere, she also played for many happy hours with Jackie. They were an interesting pair, Icodel and Zell. Icodel, cozy, always good-natured, and Zell, elegant as only a Frenchwoman can be, cultured, high-strung, often jealous of Icodel's easygoing ways, but totally loyal and responsible. What they had in common was that each loved Jackie as if she were her own child. Between the two of them, especially because Zell was always there, I could travel anywhere in the world and know that Jackie would be all right, no matter what the circumstances. An enormous relief. And in spite of the fact that each woman blamed the other for any small crisis, we all lived together quite happily for more than 30 years. Jackie was fortunate to have these two women as constants. So was I. I count my blessings that they found their way into our lives. Still, did I feel guilt? How do I count the ways? Is there a working mother on earth who doesn't? Mine was compounded in the 60s and 70s by the fact that working mothers like me were still a minority. These days, the pendulum has swung so far the other way, toward work, that sizable numbers of mothers are leaving the workforce to stay home with their children. There is no perfect solution, just exhaustion, and, my favorite word, guilt. I am known for saying that you can't have it all. A great marriage, successful career, and well-adjusted children, at least not at the same time. It's a bit easier today because there are employers who are more flexible, who may let you work part-time, and there are BlackBerries so you can work wherever you are, and there are husbands who will change diapers. But it's still a balancing act, and probably always will be. I cherished every moment I could spend with Jackie. We would sit on the floor many an afternoon and play with her mouse house, a sort of doll's house I had bought her, with little mommy and daddy mice and their mousy children. We spent every weekend I was home together, often with Shirley, who adored Jackie almost as much as I did. Summers, Lee and I rented a house in Long Island. My parents and my sister, Jackie, visited and couldn't keep their hands off our baby. They would play with her all afternoon in the sandbox or the little rubber tub we kept in the backyard. God knows how she ever learned to walk, because one or the other of them, my mother, father, or sister, was always holding her or wheeling her around the block in her stroller. Jackie rewarded them by being the most adorable girl imaginable. Almost from babyhood, Jackie would give my father what he called her show business smile. This was a big, broad smile the toddler somehow knew delighted her grandpa. My heart melted seeing my father so happy around his grandchild. Lee was also a loving and devoted father. As in many cases when a man has a second family, Lee could, and did, spend more time with his little Jackie than he did with his other two children when they were young. First of all, he had been very busy establishing his career, and second, his marriage to their mother wasn't that happy. Although it was usually the weekends when he and I could play with Jackie together, Lee was home most mornings when I was at work, and I was with her in the evenings when Lee was at one of his theaters. There was no doubt that she was the darling of our lives. As baby Jackie grew older, she loved being with her Aunt Jackie. They would do coloring books together, and the little girl particularly loved brushing and combing my sister's long blonde hair. But there gradually came the time when the little Jackie outgrew these activities with the big Jackie. Without our ever articulating it, she knew that her aunt wasn't as bright as she was. I can't remember when this actually occurred, probably when the child was about 10 or 12. But my sister always loved her namesake, and little Jackie was unfailingly kind to her. My biggest concern was when and how I should tell Jackie she was adopted. There was no question in my mind that I would. At that time, there were two popular and quite different theories. One was to wait until the child was old enough to understand and then explain that she was a chosen child. The alternative was simply not to tell the child at all. For advice, I turned to Haim Gnat, a delightful, common-sense Israeli child psychologist who appeared regularly on the Today Show and had a great sense of humor. I once asked him whether it was all right to spank a child when he or she was really naughty, and he replied, "I've always felt that if it's a choice between spanking the child or killing the child, spanking is better." But I never did spank Jackie. He suggested I should just let the adoption come up naturally with Jackie with no timetable. Dr. Gnat was very big on parents bathing with their young children of the same sex. I thought this made sense. I looked forward at the end of almost every day to taking a bath with Jackie. The tub became our adoption forum. I loved soaping her up and splashing away with her. She would sometimes touch my breasts and my body. Jackie was curious, and I felt that here would be my opportunity. I held her little body against me. "Some babies come from their mommy's tummies," I would tell her to make things understandable. "But you, my darling, you were born in my heart." I meant it then. I still do. Dean Rusk, Golda Meir, Henry Kissinger, and Prince Philip. There were times when I wondered why, as the mother of a small child, I would allow myself to work in dangerous surroundings and circumstances. The first time I questioned this was just 2 months after we'd brought Jackie home, when I was being tear-gassed at the infamous Democratic National Convention in Chicago. It was August 1968. The Vietnam War was tearing the country apart, and the rift came to a head that terrible week. And it was all being televised for everyone to see. All of us from today were staying at the Conrad Hilton Hotel, right across the street from Grant Park, where there were multiple and furious confrontations between the baton and tear gas-wielding Chicago police, the Illinois National Guard, armed with automatic weapons, and the thousands of anti-war demonstrators who had come from all over the country. Our production office in the hotel became an informal infirmary for some of the bruised and battered demonstrators. One of our production assistants was beaten with a billy club by a member of Mayor Daley's riot police, as were 21 other journalists and photographers. Our press credentials were no protection during the riots. I wasn't beaten, but I was reporting from right in front of our hotel, filming the police clubbing people and dragging them into paddy wagons. I will always remember the sickeningly sweet smell of tear gas spreading through the crowds and permeating the Hilton. In spite of it all, there was a challenge and a thrill reporting such a story. When a reporter is in danger, he or she usually loses all fear. I know I do. For a time, you put your real life aside. Or maybe this is your real life. The year 1968 had already been a violent one. Martin Luther King Jr. had been gunned down in Memphis in April, and Bobby Kennedy had been shot to death in California in June. Overseas, American soldiers were dying in increasing numbers in Vietnam. We documented the escalating casualty rate, which had reached more than 36,000 dead every morning on today, with no end in sight. President Lyndon Johnson was a political casualty of the war. He had announced at the end of March that he would not seek re-election. Thus, 5 months later, this chaotic Democratic convention had drawn many groups in support of the anti-war presidential candidates, Senators George McGovern and Eugene McCarthy. They also came to protest the potential nomination of LBJ's vice president, Hubert Humphrey, and his presumed continuation of Johnson's war policy. Those 4 days in Chicago were a nightmare for America. But for the reporters, it was where the news was and where we wanted to be. Humphrey won the Democratic nomination despite the protests, though he didn't win the presidential election. He was narrowly defeated in November by Republican Richard Nixon, thus marking the end of the Democratic administration. That included Secretary of State Dean Rusk, who had served under both President Kennedy and President Johnson, making him the second-longest-serving Secretary of State in history. Only Cordell Hull, under FDR, had held that position longer. Rusk, considered by many to be a stubborn architect of the Vietnam War, kept his own counsel and did few interviews. Knowing he was going to leave the government, everyone wanted to interview him. I did too, but I didn't think I had much of a chance. There were too many senior political and diplomatic correspondents vying for the chance, including veteran journalists Eric Severide and Walter Cronkite at CBS. Plus, I hadn't done any really important political interviews. But I had a curious advantage over the other correspondents. I'd met Rusk at a Washington cocktail party in the summer of 1967. Hugh was on vacation and I was heading the morning show alone, which the Secretary of State evidently took note of. A week into my assignment, I got an unexpected fan letter from him, which still hangs framed on the wall in my apartment. This is what he wrote. The Secretary of State, Washington, August 28, 1967. Dear Miss Walters, as a regular viewer of the Today Show, my spirit moves me to write you a little note to say how much I admire and appreciate the job you are doing. Perhaps I was moved to do so by your splendid handling of the show in August. If NBC vice presidents ever begin to bother you, show them this letter and others like it and tell them to leave you alone. Cordially yours, Dean Rusk. I was surprised and delighted with this personal and rather humorous letter from a man not known for being personal or humorous. I immediately wrote him a thank you note and asked him for an interview. He declined politely, and that was that. Then, wonder of wonders, soon after he left office, he chose me to sit down with him for his first interview. His fan letter to me had obviously been a sincere one, but still, his choosing me was very important to my career. My first serious and exclusive political interview took place in a room at the Hay Adams Hotel in Washington. Secretary Rusk and I talked for 4 long hours and covered everything from Johnson's and his controversial Vietnam policy to his own personal reminiscences of life inside the Kennedy and the Johnson administrations. When we finished, he thanked me for not asking him any frivolous or naive questions that would have embarrassed him, to which I replied that I would have been embarrassed to ask them. Then we went outside to go on to our next appointments, and it is the next moment that has stayed in my memory all these years. I had a car waiting to whisk me to the airport so I could start editing the film in New York. I presumed that the former Secretary of State would have one waiting for him as well, but he didn't. "I no longer have a government car," he told me. "I'll just grab a cab." I was stunned. Here was this man who had been one of the most powerful people in the world with cars and planes at his disposal. Here was I, a reporter, offering a lift to the former Secretary of State, a man to whom the whole country had looked. All the trappings of power and success were gone. He thanked me for my offer, but went off in a taxi. The interview was a great success. It contained so much new and historically interesting material that we cut it into 5 segments and today ran one of them every day for a week. Newspapers across the world picked up Rusk's comments and wrote stories about them. Editorials followed. It was an important milestone for me. 2 years later, I was pleased when Rusk chose me again for another headline-making interview. The top-secret Pentagon Papers had just been leaked to the New York Times, documents that chronicled the government's internal planning and clandestine actions during the Vietnam War. Rusk, then a professor of international law at the University of Georgia Law School, blamed television for much of the opposition to the Vietnam War, but he seemed beaten and heartsick as he admitted to mistakes he had made. "I myself underestimated the tenacity of the North Vietnamese and may have overestimated the ability or willingness of the American people to accept a protracted struggle of this sort," he told me. "They're an impatient people, and they like this sort of thing to come to an end." How prescient his words seem today in the clamor over Iraq. I didn't interview Rusk again, but he and I stayed in touch over the years until his death in 1994, at the age of 85. Though the first interview with Rusk helped to give me credibility as a serious political journalist, I continued to interview people in the arts. Ginger Rogers, Andrew Wyeth, Leopold Stokowski, Lauren Bacall. I particularly loved Bacall's tough candor. When I asked her about Frank Sinatra, who had proposed to her some years after the death of her husband, Humphrey Bogart, only to dump her after their engagement was leaked to the press, she pointed to the floor and snapped, "Frank is as dead and dry as this floor." Remember that phrase, "Hell hath no fury like a woman scorned"? Bacall was living proof. But now I wasn't limited to those sorts of interviews. I could move in different directions. One very important interview was with Golda Meir, then Prime Minister of Israel. American women, especially those in the throes of the women's movement, were fascinated by the very different lives of Israeli women. Women over 18 were required to serve in the Israeli armed forces. Many did manual work in collective farms or kibbutzim, and one of them, Mrs. Meir, had risen to the highest political office in the country. The prime minister seemed an unlikely role model when she arrived in the studio with her sister, who lived in Connecticut. The heavy-set, stern-looking 71-year-old woman seemed more like a rather forbidding grandmother than a head of state. Like my grandparents, Mrs. Meir's parents had emigrated from Russia. The Prime Minister was 8 when the family settled in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where she had gone to school and then to college. She had been a teacher in Milwaukee, she told me, before she and her husband immigrated in 1921 to Palestine, where she lived on a kibbutz raising chickens. Before that, she said, I was afraid to be in the room with one chicken. One of the founders of the State of Israel in 1948, she had gone on to serve as Israel's first ambassador to the Soviet Union and as Israel's Minister of Labor and then Foreign Minister before becoming Israel's first and to date only female Prime Minister. All this as a single mother of two. She and her husband had long since separated. I was always interested in how women balanced their work life and their children, so I asked whether she, as a mother, had had to make great sacrifices. Her answer did not reassure me, or American feminists, who were clamoring for child care centers modeled on Israeli child care collectives so they could work outside the home. There's no doubt the mothers pay for it with pangs of conscience, the Prime Minister said wearily. I suppose the children do too. She quoted her grown daughter as saying she'd felt sad and resentful as a child that her mother was away from home so much. But there was a trade-off, which every working mother, including me, hoped for. Her daughter also said, in retrospect, that her mother's work had added something to the home. It had given her a much broader aspect and interest. Naturally, one has a feeling that it's done wrong to the children, but it turned out all right, Mrs. Mayer said. They don't hold it against me at any rate. Years later, when I left NBC for ABC, I interviewed Mrs. Mayer during my opening week. Sadly, it would be my last interview with her. Another early interview, this one with Kathleen Neal Cleaver, the spokesperson for the militant Black Panther Party, was chilling. Married to Eldridge Cleaver, a revolutionary and convicted felon, author of the best-selling autobiography Soul on Ice, and then a fugitive living in Algiers, Kathleen articulated the racial fury among many young urban blacks at the time, which had led to riots in the Watts section of Los Angeles, Detroit, Cleveland, Newark, and nationwide after the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. The Black Panther 10-point program, however, did not reflect Dr. King's nonviolent philosophy. If black people can't have the freedoms of life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, cannot have the fruits of their labor, then we will take the position that no one can have them, she said. We will have them, or the earth will be leveled by our attempts to gain them. I tried to strike a common bond with the 24-year-old revolutionary, pointing out that she was pregnant, that I had a baby, and that both of us shared the hope that our children would grow up in a free and good society. Is there any way that the people like me and the people like you can come to some agreement, or does it have to be only a revolution? I asked. I don't see any solution other than a total change of the existing relationships in society, she replied. A total change of the economic system, of all the institutions which are not only oppressive and exploitative, but anachronistic and out of keeping with the times. We finally reached some shaky common ground when she agreed that the struggle was not restricted solely to race, but to class as well. Slave against master, she said. The lower classes against the upper classes. The classes of the ruled against the classes of the ruler. The revolution she called for never came to pass. Many of the Black Panthers succumbed to internal squabbling or were killed or imprisoned. The movement, which FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover called the greatest threat to the internal security of the country, gradually imploded. But Kathleen Cleaver went a very different route. She would go on to Yale University on a full scholarship and graduate summa cum laude and Phi Beta Kappa. After graduating from Yale Law School, she worked in the prestigious New York law firm Cravath, Swain & Moore before joining the law faculty at Emory University, where she remains today. In the midst of all this, I also had an unexpected interview with Queen Elizabeth's husband, Prince Philip, and with Henry Kissinger, President Nixon's national security advisor, both courtesy of the president himself. Nixon, in fact, turned out to be one of my greatest champions. I met him in 1969 at the White House while I was filming an interview with his daughter, Tricia, in the Rose Garden. He had the reputation of being reserved and socially awkward, but to my surprise, he seemed relaxed, and to my bigger surprise, almost charming. He was so friendly, in fact, that I kidded him about the stag dinner he was hosting that night at the White House for Prince Philip, pointing out that it seemed a clear case of sex discrimination. "Is Prince Philip going to do the Today Show?" Nixon asked me. "No," I replied. "We've tried to get him, but so far we've gotten nowhere. He's turned us down." "Tell you what," Nixon said, "I'll speak to him tonight." I had never thought of the President of the United States as a booking agent, but he turned out to be one. Late that night, I got a call from the British Embassy saying that Prince Philip would be available in the morning. Prince Philip must have been angry as hell, but we got the royal interview and inadvertently raised a furor in England. My question was simple enough. Might Queen Elizabeth ever abdicate and turn the throne over to Prince Charles? It was Prince Philip's answer. Who can tell? Anything might happen. That created huge headlines in the British press and brought out crowds in support of the Queen. Buckingham Palace had to issue a statement saying the Queen had no intention of standing down. I quickly wrote Prince Philip a note of apology that I'd put him in such an embarrassing position, and received a personal reply from him on Buckingham Palace stationery bearing the crest of the Royal Coat of Arms. "Dear Miss Walters, thank you so much for your kind and thoughtful letter. It was most appreciated by both of us. To be the means of unlocking such a spectacular display of cheerfulness and goodwill is a great satisfaction, particularly in this day and age when most demonstrations seem to reflect nothing but anger and provocation. I remember the interview very well. It appears that you have forgiven the Queen for not abdicating. Yours sincerely, Philip." A year after that, President Nixon delivered for me again. This time he persuaded Henry Kissinger to sit down for the Today Show. I was pleased, but it was hardly a personal favor done out of the goodness of the president's heart. Richard Nixon understood the use of television to promote his administration and its policies. I was well aware of that, but being on the receiving end of Nixon's television savvy wasn't all bad. We used each other, and that's the way it has worked with so many guests I've talked to over the years. People come on TV because they want the exposure and a forum to advance whatever it is they want to advance. And I want something too, the interview. So it was that I introduced Henry Kissinger to our audience in December 1970. As National Security Advisor, Kissinger was controversial, to say the least. Though one of Nixon's campaign promises had been to end the war in Vietnam, the United States was still bogged down there. Today had continued to run its roll call of combat deaths. There had been another 6,164 in 1970. But Kissinger, with his slight German accent, was a curiosity to the public and a very powerful man. We discussed at length the issues of the day, and then, because no one knew much about him, I asked him a few personal questions and got one response I particularly loved. My question was about how fame had changed his life. "The nice thing about being a celebrity is that if you bore people, they think it's their fault," he said. I interviewed Henry Kissinger many more times over the years, and we became close friends. Dr. Kissinger and his wife Nancy are frequent guests at my home and I at theirs. Of all the interviews I did with him as he went on to be Secretary of State for both Nixon and his successor, Gerald Ford, one remains foremost in my mind. It took place when I was at ABC. When his best-selling book Diplomacy was published in 1994, my producer and I took him back to Fürth, his small hometown in Germany, nestled near the larger and more famous city of Nuremberg, where the post-World War II war crimes trials of the Nazi leaders took place. It was in Fürth where his father taught him at the gymnasium, or secondary school, that Dr. Kissinger spent the first 15 years of his life. In 1938, he and his family fled the Nazis and came to America. As we strolled the streets during the interview, Kissinger reminisced about his childhood, pointing out his family's old apartment, now a manicurist's parlor, on the third floor of a building. He also took me to the site of his first passion, the town soccer stadium. As a child, Henry was an avid fan of the local soccer club. As a Jew, however, he wasn't welcome in the stadium, so he had to watch every game through the mesh at the end of the field. When we got to the stadium, I asked the cameras to turn off. "Come on," I said to him, "let's go inside." I took his arm, and the two of us walked into the stadium and quietly sat down. No one expected us. I don't know who recognized Kissinger first, but one after another, the people in the stands slowly turned their heads to look at him until everyone was staring. The soccer game stopped, and even the players were looking at him. Then the clapping began and spread around the stadium. Soon the entire stadium was on its feet, applauding its native son. We both had tears in our eyes. But back to the Today Show and another memory of a world-famous political figure. I celebrated my 40th birthday on the air. Well, celebrate may be too strong a word. Endured is more like it. There was the Dirriger cupcake with a candle in it and all sorts of funny but affectionate jokes about aging from Hugh and Joe. When the show was over, I went back to my office to find my assistant, Mary Hornicle, holding the phone with a quizzical expression on her face. "There's a man on the phone who says he's Lyndon Johnson." "You're kidding," I said. But when I took the phone and heard that familiar Texas drawl, I knew that it was, indeed, the former president. He was calling from his ranch in Texas. "Lady Bird and I are lying here in bed watching TV, and she said if you had any guts, you'd call Barbara and wish her a happy birthday," he said. "Thank you very much, Mr. President," I responded, "but the truth is this birthday does not make me very happy." I know," he said, "but you know, you really are an inspiration to women all over America." "That's nice of you to say," I told him, "but I certainly don't feel very inspiring today." "Well, let me tell you a little story," Johnson continued. "We had a man down here in Texas who ran for Congress 10 times and was defeated 10 times. Finally, after 20 years of trying, he ran again and was elected. So the press asked him, 'What do you think this means, Mr. Congressman?' And he told them, 'I'll tell you what it means. It means that if I can make it, any idiot can make it.'" Then Johnson paused and said, "And Barbara, when those women out there watch you..." I laughed and said, "Thank you, Mr. President," and hung up the phone. To this day, I don't know whether Lyndon Johnson meant to call me an inspirational idiot or just inspirational, but no matter, I was astonished and touched by his call. It sure was an improvement over my 30th birthday, when I'd gotten all dressed up in my borrowed designer outfit, only to be stood up by Gianni Uzielli. Sad times in Florida. In 1970, my family returned to Florida from New York. It was not an improvement. Aunt Lena was living in Miami Beach, and my parents rented a one-bedroom apartment in a building across the courtyard from her. My sister had to sleep in the living room on a pull-out couch, but it was all they could afford. My father was miserable. My visit to that apartment was bittersweet. I brought little Jackie with me to lighten up their lives. My mother cherished the baby, and my father lavished attention on her. But one night, my parents got into a terrible fight over her. Each accused the other of waking her up and making her cry, resulting in a series of charges and countercharges that got so angry, my father walked out of the apartment and didn't come home all night. I don't know to this day where he went. Did he sleep on a park bench? Did he walk the beach all night? My mother and I were terrified that he might once more try to take his own life, but mercifully, he reappeared in the morning. As with his suicide attempt, we didn't ask any questions. Their fight is the bitter part of my memory. The sweet part is that it was the first time my daughter kissed me. I don't know how old babies are when they learn to do that, and maybe she was just imitating a kiss, but she put her lips on my cheek and gave me the most wonderful feeling of happiness and love. I knew I had to rescue my parents and sister from that cramped apartment, or they would have killed one another. Back I went into my savings and bought them a larger two-bedroom condominium in a good, I felt I couldn't afford great, building in Miami Beach. It was in a nice enough neighborhood, and most important for my mother, it was just a two-block walk from the supermarket. In retrospect, I probably could have afforded great, and I should have bought them a condominium in a better building in Miami Beach. But I was still so afraid of the vagaries of television that I didn't have the nerve to risk more money. So they settled into their new place. My mother and sister slept in twin beds in one bedroom, my father slept in the other. And sleep is what he did most of the time. He found some men in the building to play cards with, but no one he could really talk to. My mother, who always complained that she had no friends, continued her life with at most one or two acquaintances. My parents didn't go out much and were rarely invited to other people's apartments. Remember, wherever they went, they took my sister. They didn't want to leave her home alone. And though my sister had perfect table manners and was very sweet, it was difficult to have any real conversation with her. Lee tried to help out by giving my father some work, but my father's talent was limited. It lay in producing spectacular shows with lots of sexy girls, and that didn't translate to Lee's family tent theatricals, so my father's 60-year career in show business quietly drew to a close. My sister settled in better than either of them. I got her a made-up job as a teacher's assistant at the Hope School, a local private school for intellectually impaired children. I made donations to the school and continued to do so for a great many years. It was a wonderful place. Jackie was picked up by bus every morning and stayed at the school until noon, filing papers and running errands for the teachers. She loved it and took her tasks there very seriously. Life in the new apartment, however, continued to be tense. My mother and father argued, mostly about money. I remember one bitter scene when my mother found out that my father had spent some of the money I'd sent them to buy State of Israel bonds. There had been a fundraising meeting in the building, and most of the tenants were there. "He has no money," she said to me. "How could he do it? Why does he always have to be a big shot?" Well, he wasn't being a big shot. I understood that it was important to his pride that he be able to buy a bond, just like his card-playing friends. Yes, he had been a big spender, but his talent was to see everything in a huge way. If he had listened to my mother, he never would have put his last dime into a nightclub in an old church in Boston and expected it to work. He would have taken a job selling shoes or dresses, like my uncle's, instead of traveling all the way to Nova Scotia, putting on little shows trying to earn a living for his family. So here he was, buying an Israel bond, saying, "I'm successful and can afford it," and my mother saying back, "Why do you always have to be a big shot? You can't afford it." And there I was, as always, in the middle, as my mother's messenger. "Talk to your father and tell him that he can't, that he owes," on and on. But I didn't say a word to him about the Israel bond. Instead, I quietly slipped some cash into his pocket. Both my mother and father hated being financially dependent on me and constantly apologized about it. I used to respond, "Everything I am, you made me. You sent me to good schools. You allowed me to travel. You taught me to read and be curious. I'm lucky to have the chance to pay you both back." And I meant it. Oddly, the man who'd always thrown financial discretion to the wind worried constantly that I'd lose my job. "Do your bosses like you?" he would ask. "After that show, did they send you a note?" Here was a man who'd never been the slightest bit nervous about his own future, yet he constantly fretted about mine. He saw my career through the lens of show business, just one bad review from closing. But then again, so did I. Some magazine, I can't remember which, did a profile of me around that time and quoted my father as saying that my childhood years of such financial instability had cast a halo of fear over me. It was in that same article that I learned that he had indeed considered becoming a salesman to support us after the death of vaudeville. What a tragedy that would have been. My father cast as the self-deceiving Willie Loman, the doomed, disillusioned character in Death of a Salesman. During this depressing time in Florida, I began more and more to see my father in a different light. Instead of seeing him only as a man who had neglected his wife and children and was never home, I also saw him as a man who stayed with a woman he could have left years earlier. A disappointed woman who had trouble sharing his dreams. But how could she share his dreams? They had turned into nightmares for her. My father had run through several fortunes, even cashing in his life insurance policy, and was reduced to financial dependency on his daughter. She had had to endure one tragedy after another, one child dying at 14 months and another child mentally retarded. Yet to her very great credit, she remained a loving mother to my sister, helping her dress every day, doing her hair, being her constant companion. She also remained a devoted wife, in her way, to my father, fussing over him, cooking his favorite foods, brewing his tea in a teapot. No one can ever really understand other people's relationships, and I didn't try. As much as I loved my mother and my father, I was always relieved to return to my work in New York. In July 1969, I was given the plum assignment to go to North Wales in Great Britain to cover the investiture of Prince Charles as Prince of Wales. Royal investitures are elaborate, lengthy, and rare pageants. This one, bestowing the title on the 20-year-old heir to the British throne, was only the second in the 20th century and followed well-defined traditions unchanged over the centuries. Every moment, every costume and prop, every participant has some sort of ancient meaning, and I had to know every one of them. I had some help from Princess Margaret's husband, Lord Snowden, whom I'd interviewed for today and who was the architect of the elaborate ceremony. We were in Wales for a week, and all I can remember today is that there was a gentleman usher of the black rod and a silver stick in waiting, but by God, when we went on the air for 5 straight hours, I knew every stick and rod there was and why and what they were supposed to do with them. I had also memorized every historic name and its significance and could identify virtually every prince, princess, duke, duchess, earl, and lady what's-her-face coming out of the 13th century Carnarvon Castle after the ceremony, including Lord Snowden, who was running about in a green velvet suit looking rather like a little elf. With it all, I loved Wales and had a wonderful time. After that, I just kept going. The Today Show traveled all over the place, to Jamaica, where I remember getting high on rum with Hugh and his wife Ruth, to the Greek islands, where Wim Welpen, a very funny and beloved producer, writer, Barbara Gordon and I drank ouzo at the local taverna and learned to do Greek dances. We looked like a poor man's version of Zorba. There were trips to Holland, Italy, Portugal, and also to Romania, where the Communist May Day parade thundered right past our hotel, as well as a memorable freezing cold trip to Ireland, where our wise prop man gave us our early morning orange juice with a big shot of Irish whiskey in it. Some of the happiest mornings I've ever had. Scotland was more sobering. I went down into a coal mine, and it was a devastating experience. The blackness, the utter dark, the feeling of death. I brought home a piece of coal from that mine and kept it for years on a table in my living room as a stark reminder. Our trip to Japan presented another reminder. My gender. The Japanese invited Hugh everywhere but wouldn't invite me because I was a woman. So I spent a lot of time in my hotel room. Hugh had a swell time in Japan. I didn't. Don't think the gender issue was restricted to Japan. At NBC, the men in suits had not undergone consciousness-raising either. The women's movement was in full cry by the end of the 60s, but they barely seemed to notice. Women's groups all over the country were holding demonstrations to legalize abortion and to demand equal pay for equal work. Women were picketing the New York Times and other newspapers around the country to protest sex-segregated want ads, executive training openings for men, Gal Friday openings for women, and men-only bars and restaurants, including the Oak Room at the Plaza Hotel in New York and the Polo Lounge of the Beverly Hills Hotel in Los Angeles. One display of women's determination took place in New York in the summer of 1970, when some 50,000 women, led by Betty Friedan, marched down Fifth Avenue in what was called Women's Strike for Equality. 50,000 is a lot of women, and not surprisingly, the turnout got a ton of press. I wrote a memo to the president of NBC News, Reuven Frank, suggesting a special hour on the women's movement. This is the reply I got from him. Not enough interest. The dismissive attitude of many men toward women at the time was certainly not limited to NBC, but was pervasive throughout the media. We few women journalists in television were struggling to find our places in the male-dominated newsroom, and none of us knew if it would ever change. Winning Nixon, losing Sinatra. At the same time that women were fighting for equal rights, I unexpectedly added a new arrow to my bow. You know that old saw, one thing leads to another? Well, an article I wrote in the late 60s certainly proved that expression true. It provided what I hoped was helpful advice about how to talk to a celebrity. It was prompted by a new trend emerging at the time, celebrity lectures. More and more names were traveling around the country to speak, for money, to all different kinds of organizations and charities. The growing business of lecturing meant that more and more so-called ordinary people were meeting these celebrities, searching for something memorable to say, or trying to connect personally with the speaker if only for a moment in time, yet not having a clue how to make that connection. I drew from my own budding celebrity the kinds of things people said to me, which were often mistakes like, "You look better in person than you do on television." How do I answer that? Thanks a lot. It took me 2 hours of makeup and hair and I still look lousy on television? Or, what was just as well-meaning, but worse, "You look so much better on television than you do in person." I still can't think of the right response to that one. I wrote the article and thought that was it, until I shortly thereafter got a letter from Doubleday. It contained, you should excuse the expression, an offer I couldn't refuse. Ken McCormick, the editor-in-chief, had read the article and thought it could be expanded into a little book for tongue-tied, socially awkward people, the many people who worry that they can't think of the right thing to say to start a conversation. And so, I set to work on how to talk with practically anybody about practically anything. The idea was that there were all kinds of situations in which people just didn't know what to say. These situations included not only when talking to a celebrity, but to someone you don't know at a dinner party, to a person who has just lost a loved one, to a child, to an athlete when you know nothing about sports, to a tycoon, even to a bore. The book was published in 1970. I thought it was a nice, helpful little book, but to my great surprise, it became something of a phenomenon. It just kept selling and selling. There I am on the cover in a bright pink dress with my real dark hair smiling away. No wonder I'm smiling. By now the book has been through 8 printings, sold thousands and thousands of copies worldwide, and been translated into more than 6 languages. People still come up to me with old copies to autograph. I continue to be amazed by its success. In writing the book, I drew on my own social awkwardness because I was still rather shy off camera. To make the book more fun, I also threw in anecdotes from almost every celebrity I knew, and there weren't that many. Mostly, there were a lot of mentions of Hugh Downs and Bennett Cerf, the 2 celebrities I knew the best at the time. Bennett, the head of Random House, the publishing company, was best known for his many years on the enormously popular television quiz show, What's My Line? He was also known as a great raconteur, and I quoted him throughout the book. But mostly, the advice came from my own everyday experiences. Want to know how to tell if a guy not wearing a wedding ring is married? My advice was to admire his tie, jacket, sweater, whatever, and say, How good-looking. Did your wife choose that for you? Simple, and you get your answer. Want to get some tycoon to open up? Just ask for a description of his or her very first job. Trust me, everyone, from presidents and movie stars to policemen and moving men, remembers his or her first job and will relate it in minute detail. I used as one of my examples my meeting with the Greek shipping tycoon Aristotle Onassis, soon to marry Jackie Kennedy. I had been invited by his press people to meet Mr. Onassis at a lunch in New York. When I arrived, looking better in person than I did on television, Onassis was surrounded by shipping people busily discussing tonnage. I sat silently until there was a momentary lull in the conversation, and then, all wide-eyed with curiosity, I inquired, "I wonder, as I listened to you extremely successful gentlemen, how you all began. For example, Mr. Onassis, what was your very first job?" There was no more talk of tonnage. Onassis traced his first jobs as a young immigrant from Turkey to Argentina. His father had been jailed during the persecution of the Greeks by the Turks, starting as a dishwasher, then becoming a construction worker, and finally a cigarette salesman, which ultimately led to his first fortune. By the end of lunch, Mr. Onassis was my new best friend, and moreover, had agreed to let me interview him on his legendary yacht, the Christina, with its swimming pool and gold bathroom fixtures. Sadly, his schedule and the NBC camera crews didn't work out, so I never got that interview. Who knows, had we worked things out, I, instead of Jackie Kennedy, might have been the next Mrs. Aristotle Onassis. Yeah, right. From tycoons and VIPs to drunks and lechers, I kept ladling out advice. I wrote how I squelched one persistent knee-grabber at a dinner party by looking deep into his eyes and saying, "You're absolutely right. We are meant for each other. Why don't you divorce your wife and marry me?" I never felt his hand again. I ended the book with, "When all else fails, 20 surefire conversation starters." Some came from my friends and colleagues, but others were ones I used in interviews. Here are a few that would still work today. 1. If you were not doing the work you are now doing, what would you most like to be doing? 2. If you could live at any time in history, when would you have wished to live? 3. If you could be any person in history, who would it be? 4. If you were suddenly given $1 million and told that you had to spend it just on yourself, what is the first thing you would buy? 5. If you were hospitalized for 3 months, but not really too sick, whom, and it can't be relative, would you want in the next bed? The last question was one of my favorites because it got so many funny answers. The comedian Alan King chose the actor Richard Burton because Burton's then-wife, Elizabeth Taylor, would come to visit. Liberace, the flamboyant pianist, chose the secretive, taciturn Greta Garbo so that he could do all the talking. Johnny Carson didn't miss a beat with his answer, "The best damn doctor in town." One day I hope to update this little book with its somewhat useful and sometimes entertaining advice. But first I've got to finish this tome, so let's get back to the early 70s. My budding celebrity also had its dark side. Most people in the public eye get lots of letters, some from fans, some from crabby critics, still others from prisoners incarcerated in their respective prisons. So I paid little attention to a love letter I received from a besotted fan during my early time on the Today Show, saying how much he adored me. Then came the second, third, and fourth letters from the same man, and an ominous change in tone. He wanted to kill the Pope. He wanted to kill Lee. "I watch you," he wrote. "I see you." It was frightening. Was he watching me leave my apartment in the pre-dawn stillness of New York? Was he planning to throw acid in my face between the building and the car? Was he really planning to kill Lee? It is a federal offense to send death threats through the mail. And luckily, my stalker wasn't too bright. He put his return address on the letters. We went to the police and they arrested him in his apartment in the Bronx. He turned out to be a big man who struggled violently to escape arrest, and we breathed easier when he was in custody. Lee pressed charges, and he was sent to jail. That made us breathe even easier. My anxiety rose again when some time later the authorities notified us he'd been released from jail, but mercifully, I didn't hear from him. I continue to this day to get letters from fans and non-fans and prisoners, most of whom declare their innocence, but I have never been threatened again. Very scary experience. On a much happier note, in the summer of 1970, I met a man who would become my advisor and very dear friend. His name was Lee Stevens, and he was an agent with the William Morris Agency, then, as now, one of the biggest theatrical agencies in the business. The agency represented many top actors, directors, and writers. They represented no one in news. No talent agency did at that time. None of us in television news had agents. At least, I don't think anyone did. People in news were considered too pure to ask for anything as crass as more money. Agents were for entertainers. Those of us in the news division were supposed to treat the industry as if it were a privilege to belong. True, we were far better paid than print journalists who came close to taking vows of poverty, but still, none of us were getting rich. People in the television entertainment divisions, however, made tons of money and had agents and managers and publicists and lawyers. In 1970, Johnny Carson, for example, was reputed to be making some $3 million a year. But we journalists were a different species. In my case, every time my contract was renewed, I'd simply be called in and told what my salary was going to be, and I'd say, "Thank you, good Lord." It never occurred to me to question my salary. Then one day, Lee Stevens came to lunch along with Hugh and his wife Ruth and assorted other people at a summer house my husband Lee and I were renting for a month. The two Lees were friends. They were both in show business, where even dog acts had agents. Lee Stevens assumed I had an agent as well, and was amazed when I told him I didn't. To make a long story short, by the time that very pleasant summer afternoon was over, I not only had a new friend, I had an agent. I had no idea at the time what a pivotal role he would play in my professional life.